to Jamestown, as the Spanish began the conquest of the Americas in the 1490s, England was a minor European power recovering from the devastating effects of a civil war, the Wars of the Roses. She was in no state to take advantage of the scramble for loot and gold, an opportunity to exploit the indigenous people of the Americas. Nearly 100 years later, in 1588, the lucky rout of the Spanish Armada, an attempt by King Philip II of Spain to invade England, sent political shockwaves around Europe. Fortunate though, England's victory was a sign of growing English assertiveness on a seas that would enable them to take part in the quest for a colonial empire. It is thus no coincidence that the English began their colonization of North America at exactly the same time, but they were already latecomers. They chose North America not because it was attractive, but because it was all that they was available. The desirable parts of Americas where the indigenous population to exploit was plentiful, and where the gold and silver mines were located had already been occupied. The English got the leftovers when an 18th century English writer and agriculturist, Arthur Young, discussed where profitable staple products, by which he meant exportable agricultural goods, were produced. He noted, "It appears upon the whole that the staple productions of our colonies decrease in value in proportion to their distance from the sun. In the West Indies, which are hottest of all, they make to the amount of 81/12 seconds/1 day per head. In the southern continental ones, to the amount of 51/10 seconds. In the central ones, to amounts of 5/9 seconds/6.5 days. In a northern settlement to that of 2/60. This scale surely suggests a most important lesson: to avoid colonizing in northern latitudes. The first English attempt to plant a colony at Roanoke in North Carolina between 1585 and 1587 was a complete failure. In 1607, they tried again. Shortly before the end of 1606, three vessels, Susan, Constant, Godspeed, and Discovery, under the command of Captain Christopher Newport, set off of Virginia. The colonists, under auspices of the Virginia Company, sailed into Chesapeake Bay and up a river they named James, after the ruling of the English monarch, James I. On May 14, 1607, they founded a settlement of Jamestown. Though the settlers on board the ships owned by Virginia Company were English, they had a model of colonization heavily influenced by the templates set up by Cortes Pizarro and de Toledo. Their first plan was to capture a local chief and use him as a way to get provisions and to coerce the population into producing goods and wealth for them. When they first landed in Jamestown, the English colonists did not know they were within the territory claimed by a Powhatan Confederacy, a coalition of some 30 politics owing allegiance to a king called Wahunsocoq. Wahunsocoq's capital was at the town of Werowocomoco, a mere 20 miles from Jamestown. The plan of the colonists was to learn more about the lay of the land. If the locals could not be induced to provide food and labor, the colonists might at least be able to trade with them. The notion that the settlers themselves will work and grow their own food seems not to have crossed their minds. That is not what conquerors of the New World did. Wahunsocoq quickly became aware of colonists' presence and viewed their intentions with great suspicion. He was in charge of what for North America was quite a large empire, but he had many enemies and lacked overwhelming centralized political control of the Incas. Wahunsocoq decided to see what the intentions of the English were, initially sending messengers saying that he desired friendly relations with them. As the winter of 1607 closed in, the settlers in Jamestown began to run low on food. The appointed leader of the colony's ruling council, Edward Mary Wingfield, bittered indecisively. The situation was rescued by Captain John Smith. Smith, whose writings provide one of her main sources of information about the early development of the colony, was a larger-than-life character. Born in England in rural Lincolnshire, he disregarded his father's desire for him to go into the business and instead became a soldier of fortune. He first fought with English armies in the Netherlands, after which he joined Austrian forces serving in Hungary, fighting against the armies of the Ottoman Empire. Captured in Romania, he was sold as a slave and put to work as a field hand. He managed one day to overcome his master and, stealing his clothes and his horse, escape back into Austrian territory. Smith had got himself into trouble on a voyage to Virginia, was imprisoned on the Susan Constant for mutiny after defying the orders of Wingfield. When the ships reached the New World, the plan was to put him on trial. To immense horror of Wingfield, Newport, the other elite colonists, however, when they opened their sealed orders, they discovered that Virginia Company had nominated Smith to be a member of the ruling council that was to govern Jamestown. With Newport sailing back to England for supplies and more colonists, and Wingfield uncertain about what to do, it was Smith who saved the colony. He initiated a series of trading missions that secured vital food supplies. On one of these, he was captured by Opegano, one of the Wakunu's youngest brothers, and was brought before a king at Wuramoko. He was the first Englishman to meet Wahun Sa Nokok. It was initial meeting that, according to some accounts, Smith's life was saved only at the intervention of Wakunka's young daughter, Pakotas. Freed on January 2nd, 1608, Smith returned to Jamestown, which was still perilously low on food, until the timely return of Newport from England later on the same day. The colonists of Jamestown learned little from this initial experience. As 1608 proceeded, they continued their quest for gold and precious metals. They still did not seem to understand that to survive, they could not rely on locals to feed them through either coercion or trade. It was Smith who was the first to realize the model of colonization that had worked so well for Cortes and Pizarro simply would not work in North America. The underlying circumstances were just too different. Smith noted that unlike Aztecs and Incas, the people of Virginia did not have gold. Indeed, he noted in his diary, "Victuals, you must know, is all their wealth." Addis Tocchio, one of the early settlers who left an extensive diary, expressed well the frustration of Smith and few others on which this recognition dawned. There was no talking, no hope, no work, but dig gold, refine gold, load gold. When Newport sailed for England in April 1608, he took a cargo of pride, fool's gold. He returned at the end of September with orders from the Virginia Company to take firmer control over the locals. Their plan was to crown Wakono, hoping this would render him subservient to the English King James I. They invited him to Jamestown, but Wakunko, still deeply suspicious of the colonists, had no intention of risking capture. John Smith recorded Wakunko's reply, "If your king have sent me presents, I also am a king, and this is my land. Your father is to come to me, not I to him, nor yet to your fort, neither will I bite at such a bait." With a Wakunko who would not bite at such a bait, Newport and Smith would have to go to Wakunko to undertake coronation. The whole event appears to have been a complete fiasco, with the only thing coming out of it to resolve on the part of Wakunko that it was time to get rid of the colony. He imposed a trade embargo. Jamestown could no longer trade for supplies. Wakunko would starve them out. Newport set sail once more for England in December 1608. He took with him a letter written by Smith, pleading with the directors of the Virginia Company to change the way they thought about the colony. There was no possibility of get-rich-quick exploitation of Virginia along the lines of Mexico and Peru. There were no gold or precious metals, and indigenous people could not be forced to work or provide food. Smith realized that if there were going to be a viable colony, it was colonists who would have to work. He therefore pleaded with directors to send the right sort of people. When you send again, I entreat you rather to send sturdy carpenters, husbandmen, gardeners, fishermen, blacksmiths, masons and diggers, up of trees, roots well provided than 1,000 of such as we have. Smith didn't know any more useless goldsmiths. Once more, Jamestown survived only because of its resourcefulness. He managed to cajole and bully local indigenous groups to trade with him, and when they wouldn't, he took what he could. Back in the settlement, Smith was completely in charge and imposed a rule: he will not work, shall not eat. Jamestown survived a second winter. The Virginia Company was intended to be a money-making enterprise, and after two disastrous years, there was no whiff or profit. The directors of the company decided that they needed a new model of governance, replacing the ruling council with a single governor. The first man appointed to this position was Sir Thomas Yates. Heeding some aspects of Smith's warning, the company realized they had to try something new. This realization was driven home by the events of the winter of 1609-1610, that so-called starving time. The new mode of governance left no room for Smith, who, disgruntled, returned to England in the autumn of 1609. Without his resourcefulness and with Wakono drawing the full supply, the colonists in Jamestown perished. Of the 500 who entered the winter, only 60 were alive by March. The situation was so desperate that they resorted to cannibalism. The something new, quote unquote, was that was imposed on the colony by Gates and his deputy, Sir Thomas Dale, was a work regimen of draconian severity for English settlers, though not, of course, for the elite running colony. It was Dale who propagated laws benign, moral, martial. This included clauses: no man or woman shall run away from the colony to the Indians upon a pain of death. Anyone who robs a garden, public or private, or vineyard, or who steals ears of corn shall be punished with that. No member of the colony will sell or give any commodity of this country to a captain, mariner, master, or sailor to transport out of the colony for his own private uses upon pain of death. If the indigenous peoples could not be exploited, reasoned the Virginia Company, perhaps the colonists could. The new model of the colonial development entailed the Virginia Company owning all the land. Men were housed in barracks and given company-determined rations. The work gangs were chosen, each one overseen by an agent of the company. It was closed to martial law, with execution with as the punishment of a first resort. As part of the new institutions for the colony, the first clause just given is significant: the company threatening with death those who ran away. Given the new work regimen, running away to live with the locals became more and more attractive option for colonists who had to work. Also available given the low density of even indigenous populations in Virginia at the time, was prospect of going it alone at the frontier beyond the control of the Virginia Company. The power of the company in the face of these options was limited. It could not coerce the English settlers into hard work as subsistence rations. Map 2 opposite shows an estimate population density of different regions of the Americas at the time of Spanish conquest. The population density of the United States, outside of the few pockets, was at most 3/4 of the person per square kilometer. In central Mexico and in Peru, the population density was as high as 400 people per square kilometer. More than 500 times higher, what was possible in Mexico or Peru was not feasible in Virginia. It took Virginia Company some time to recognize that its initial model of colonization did not work in Virginia. It took a while, too, for the failure of laws, divine, moral, martial, to sink in it. Starting in 1618, a dramatically new strategy was adopted. Since it was possible to coerce neither the locals nor the settlers, the only alternative was to give the settlers incentives. In 1618, the company began the head rice system, which gave each male settler 50 arges of land, 50 more arges for each one member of his family, for all servants that a family could bring to Virginia. Settlers were given their houses free from their contract, and in 1619, a general assembly was introduced that effectively gave all adult men a stay in laws and institutions governing the colony. It was the start of democracy in the United States. It took the Virginia Company 12 years to learn its first lesson that what had worked for the Spanish in Mexico and in Central and South America would not work in the North. The rest of the 17th century saw a long series of struggles over the second lesson, that the only option for economically viable colony was to create institutions that gave the colonists incentives to invest and work hard. As North America developed, English elites tried time and time again to set up institutions that would heavily restrict economic and political rights for all and the privileged few of the inhabitants of the colony, just as the Spanish did. Yet in each case, this model broke down as it had in Virginia. One of the most ambitious attempts began soon after the change in strategy of the Virginia Company. In 1632, 10 million acres of land on the upper Chicxulub Bay were granted by the English King Charles I to Celsius Coleridge, Lord Baltimore. The Charter of Maryland gave Lord Baltimore complete freedom to create a government along any lines he wished, with Clause 7 noting the Baltimore had for the good and happy government of the said province free full and absolute power by the tenor of these presents to ordain, make, and enact laws of what kind soever. Baltimore drew up a detailed plan for creating manorial society, a North American variant of the idealized version of 17th century rural England. It entailed dividing the land into plots of thousands of acres, which would be run by lords. The lord would recruit the tenants, who would work the lands and pay rents to the privileged elite controlling the land. Another similar attempt was made later in 1663, with the founding of Carolina by 8 proprietors, including Sir Anthony Ashley Cooper. Ashley Cooper, along with his secretary, the great English philosopher John Locke, formulated the fundamental constitutions of Carolina. This document, like Charter of Maryland before it, provided a blueprint for elites' hierarchical society based on the control by landed elites. The preamble noted that the governments of this province may be made by most agreeable to the monarchy under which we live, of which this province is part, and that we may avoid erecting a numerous democracy. The clauses of the fundamental constitutions laid out a rigid social structure. At the bottom were the elite men, with a clause 23 noting, all the children of elite men shall be elite men, and so to all generations. Above the elite man, who had no political power, were the landgraves and caciques, who were to form an aristocracy. Landgraves were to be allocated 48,000 acres of land each, and caciques 24,000 acres. There was to be a parliament in which landgraves and caciques were represented, but it would be permitted to debate only those measures that would previously be approved by the 8 proprietors. Just as the attempt to impose draconian rule in Virginia failed, so did the plans for the same type of institutions in Maryland and Carolina. The reasons were similar. In all cases, it proved to be impossible to force settlers into a rigid hierarchical society because there were simply too many options open to them in the New World. Instead, they had to be provided with incentives for them to want to work. And soon, they were demanding more economic freedom and further political rights. In Maryland, too, settlers insisted on getting their own land and they forced Lord Baltimore into creating an assembly. In 1691, the assembly induced the king to declare Maryland a crown colony, thus removing the political privileges of Baltimore and his great lords. A similar protracted struggle took place in Carolina, again with proprietors losing. South Carolina became a royal colony in 1729. By the 1720s, all the 13 colonies of what was to become the United States had similar structures of the government. In all cases, there was a governor. In all cases, there was a governor, an assembly based on franchise or male property holders. There were not democracies, women, slaves, and propertyless could not vote. But political rights were very broad and compared with temporary societies elsewhere. It was these assemblies and their leaders, the coalesced to form the first Congress in 1774, the prelude to the independence of the United States. The assemblies believed they had the right to determine both their own membership and the right to taxation. This, as we know, created problems for English colonial governments.